Nociones Comunes, Universidad Experimental de Madrid. Toda la información en nuestro canal de Telegram Nociones Comunes o en nuestra web traficantes.net/formación.
Hola, pues nada, daros la bienvenida a todas, a todos, a todos a esta primera sesión del curso La fantasía de la automatización, inteligencia artificial, trabajos y futuros del capitalismo. Para esta primera sesión que tenemos la suerte de contar con Aaron Meranab, que es historiador de teoría económica y social, especializado en la historia del trabajo y la economía del trabajo del siglo XIX y XX y forma parte también del equipo editorial, por ejemplo, de la International Labor and Working Class History y otras revistas especializadas en los derechos laborales y la lucha de los trabajadores y trabajadoras. Y es profesor ahora en la Universidad de Siracusa. Entre otras cosas y entre otros textos, ha publicado el título que da nombre también a esta primera sesión, que es La automatización y el futuro del trabajo, que hemos publicado desde Traficantes de Sueños y que también engloba un poco todo el eje que vamos a intentar de discutir a lo largo del resto de las sesiones que iremos desarrollando. En él habla de la obsolescencia laboral y del fin del trabajo, no tanto desde la perspectiva que nos intentan introducir de un futuro robotizado, de un futuro automatizado, de un futuro donde la IA, digamos, suplantará cualquier trabajo, sino desde una perspectiva de la crisis del capital, desde una perspectiva de la crisis de inversión centrada en las bajas demandas del sector, de los tres principales sectores industriales y del sector servicios. En este contexto, en vez de un futuro robotizado, la propuesta es más bien un futuro de empleo precario, un futuro de empleo poco remunerado, de trabajo informal, de trabajo a ratos y que probablemente sea más el futuro que nos espera. Y en este contexto también acaba un poco el libro y también esta presentación proponiéndonos el papel que los movimientos sociales podrían jugar en este contexto y también cómo pensar soluciones más allá de algunas que de la primera vez se nos pueden ocurrir como la renta básica y buscar soluciones a través del reparto para todas y de una... Así que también, como sabéis, la sesión será en inglés. Marta, a la que agradecemos mucho, está haciendo la traducción simultánea. Podéis elegir el idioma sobre un icono que hay seleccionado en la parte de abajo. Y como es un poco cansado, vamos a intentar que la sesión sea un poquito más corta de lo habitual. Y también luego os pediremos que os traduzcáis a vosotras mismas la parte de preguntas si podéis hacerlo. Así que, sin más, pues dar las gracias a Aaron por esta sesión y a vosotros por estar aquí. Y a Marta por traducir. Aaron, we are not hearing
you. Yeah, we are not hearing you. I think you are in mute.
I forgot to unmute myself. I'm sorry. okay, so all good?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Great. So today I'm going to talk to you a little bit about my book and about how to think about what's going on today in the world of technology, in the economy, and especially as they impact work and workers. The starting point for my talk is the rise of what I call a new automation discourse. Today, automation theorists claim that we're living in an age of accelerating technological change, which is going to bring about the end of work as we know it. And we've seen these claims return again in a very big way around generative AI and ChatGPT, which I'll talk about a little bit later on. The core ideas of this automation theory, there's four ideas at the core. The first one is that automation theorists say, look around you, workers are already being displaced by ever more advanced machines and computers. They say that this displacement is a sign that we're on the verge of achieving a largely or fully automated society. They then argue that automation should entail our collective liberation from toil, from work, but since most people have to work in order to live, automation could turn out to be a nightmare. And finally, the conclusion they draw is that the only way to prevent a nightmare of mass unemployment is to implement a universal basic income, a UBI, and transition to a post-scarcity world. Automation theorists look beyond our present moment to a brilliant future, which they say we could access in the next few decades, a world without work, a world where we have access to any goods and services that we want, a world where there's no more money or markets, and where our lives are defined not by the effort to survive, but rather by the search for humanity's search for meaning. Left-wing theorists have also adopted these ideas. Authors like Aaron Bastani, for example, they say that we should adopt a perspective of accelerationism, that we should call for more automation than is taking place. They dream up AI-based forms of digital socialism, where AI can centrally plan an economy. And they imagine that these things could bring about a fully automated luxury communism. So what's the evidence in favor of these views? How would we know whether or not these authors are correct in their predictions?
Entonces, lo que decían de español.
So when authors make these claims, they typically turn to two kinds of evidence. One kind of evidence is evidence about new technologies. So they point to advanced industrial robotics, like the ones that you see here in the Tesla factory in California. They talk about machine learning and artificial intelligence, and especially today about a new form of artificial intelligence called generative AI, one version of which is ChatGPT. But in addition to this evidence about technologies, they can also point to some very scary trends in the economy. So one trend, using the US as an example here, is that there's been a series of what economists call jobless recoveries. That means that after every recession, it takes longer and longer for the labor market to recover, for the number of people who lost their jobs to find new jobs that they had before the recession. So it's taken longer and longer to achieve that. The other thing that economists point to and that automation theorists talk about are these growing gaps between wages and productivity. Workers are becoming more productive at work, but most of those gains are being captured by employers and also by professionals. So the average worker is not really seeing the kinds of gains that they would have in an earlier era. And so the question is, how are these technological innovations and labor market trends connected? The automation theorists say that the technologies are what's causing these economic dislocations. And the question is, are they correct about that? In other words, is automation what's responsible for the difficulties workers face in finding or holding on to jobs? That's a question that I try to answer in my book, and I'm going to give you a little bit of an introduction to what I say. And, you know, I'm happy to answer questions about it. If you want a fuller account, definitely check out the book itself. So in the book, one of the things I do is I focus on the manufacturing sector. It's true that most people are not employed in manufacturing anymore. But manufacturing is the part of the economy where these new technologies have had their biggest effects. And the question is, what do we see in this sector? Well, we know that companies have been buying up a lot of robots and bringing them into production. And you can see that some of the countries with the most robots are countries like Korea, Singapore, Japan, so countries in East Asia, but also countries in Northern Europe, like Germany and Sweden. You can see Spain back there too, not that far behind the Netherlands and Italy. At the same time, as we've seen more and more robots being adopted, we can also note this trend of what economists call deindustrialization and what I call global waves of deindustrialization, that over time in country after country, there's been this tendency for the share of the workforce that's employed in industry, and especially manufacturing, which is one part of industry, there's been a tendency for that level to decline. So you can see here these waves in countries like the UK and Italy and South Korea. And these trends have even affected countries like Brazil and South Africa, which never industrialized very strongly in the first place. Even there, there's been a real decline in industrial employment. You might think that's because all of these jobs are moving to China, but actually even China, as it's become this manufacturing center of the world, it too has deindustrialized for the last 10 years. There was a period when China saw a really rapid increase in industrial employment between when it joined the WTO and about 2013. But since then, there's been this decline in manufacturing employment shares. So again, the question I want to answer is this loss of employment in manufacturing due to the adoption of robots? Is that the explanation of what's going on here? Because that's a core claim that the automation theorists are making. And here we're going to talk about a little bit of math, but it's really, really simple math. All you need to know is addition and subtraction. And basically, what I'm going to show you are the relationship between these three terms. One is output. That's like the real inflation adjusted value of what companies are producing, basically how much stuff the economy is producing. The second thing we're going to talk about is employment, just how many people are working. And the third thing is productivity, which is how much output or value is produced for every worker employed. People often ask me, why do we care about worker productivity? What we're talking about is machine productivity. But the way these statistics are constructed, anytime you replaced people with machines, it would show up in these statistics because we would see the remaining workers, there'd be more value produced for every hour that those workers worked, whoever or whatever was responsible for that increase. And the basic relationship that you need to know is that when you increase the amount of output you produce, you can do that in one of two ways. You can either increase the number of people working in a company, or you can increase their productivity. And the sum, or the when you add the change in employment to the change in productivity, that's how you get the change in output. That might seem complicated, but I'm going to give you two really easy examples so you can understand what I'm talking about. In the first example, think about a car company that produces cars. And this car company reports that it increased its output by 3% this year. So it produced 3% more cars this year compared to last year. The company also reported that there was no increase in productivity in this factory, in its factories. We know that if this company increased production by 3% and there was no increase in productivity, they had to have hired 3% more workers. It's just a mathematical relationship. The same thing would be true in the reverse case. Let's imagine this car company reports that they increased the number of cars they produced by 3% this year, and productivity per worker rose by 3%. Well, in this case, all of that additional production just comes from rising productivity. We would know mathematically that this company hasn't hired any additional workers. They're producing 3% more cars with the same number of workers. Those workers are just more productive. I hope these examples make sense. It's just simple addition, but I'm happy to answer questions about it if you find it difficult, because some of these relationships sometimes are hard to understand. What I'm going to show you now is the actual relationship that's going on in the United States as an example. So in the United States, over the last 20 years or so, what's happened is that output has grown by 1% per year and productivity has grown by 3% per year. And basically, that implies that employment was growing by negative 2% per year, because 3 plus negative 2 is 1. So basically, you know, you see this relationship that the automation theorists are talking about. If I summarize it in words, I would say, okay, in America, we're producing more and more stuff with fewer and fewer workers. And that's exactly what the automation theorists are talking about. So it seems like really good support for their argument. And they repeat this argument all the time. But if I zoom out and show you what's happened over time, over history, the picture starts to look really different. So this is the same kind of information, but here we can see what's been happening going all the way back to the 1950s. And what you'll notice is that that middle bar, productivity, that isn't changing at all. Productivity is growing by a steady 3% per year in this example. There's been no increase, no big break where robots were adopted and productivity suddenly, you know, grew at a much faster pace than before. What's really been happening? We see that in the 1950s and 60s and even 70s and 80s, output grew a lot faster. That means that American firms were just producing a lot more stuff than they are today. There's been this really sharp decline in the growth rate of these companies, what they produce. There hasn't really been a real increase in their productivity. That's something very different. It means that the economy from a manufacturing perspective is slowing down, not that productivity is speeding up. It's the opposite of what the automation theorists say should be happening. And actually these numbers, they make the situation seem a lot better than it really is. There's this economist in the United States named Susan Houseman, and she disputes these manufacturing statistics. What she shows is that if you break up the manufacturing sector and look at all the little subsectors, you can see them all listed here, although unfortunately in English, what you'll see is that actually, there's just one sector where productivity has been growing at a very rapid pace, and that affects the average for the whole manufacturing sector. That's computer and electronics products. And basically what happens here, according to Susan Houseman, is that the US government mismeasures productivity growth in the sector. They treat the production of ever faster chips as if it were the same as producing more chips. So they're not really producing so many more chips, but the chips are getting faster, and there's an accounting technique they use there. So what Susan Houseman says is if you remove this one part of manufacturing and look at all the rest of the sector without computers and electronics, what you find is that both productivity and output grew a lot more slowly than the statistics suggest. And recently, the US government redid its statistics. And you see this incredible pattern, which we've never seen before, which is that in the 2010s, in this period where we were hearing so much about automation, the absolute level of productivity in manufacturing actually fell. It's not even that it grew more slowly. It's that it fell. Companies in America became less efficient in that decade rather than more efficient. And that's very surprising. When you look at similar numbers for other countries, so this is just the same information I showed you in those charts, but now in a table, and this is for Germany and Japan, we see a very similar pattern. Germany and Japan have way more robots than the US companies do, as I showed you in an earlier slide, but we see the same pattern of falling productivity growth over time. These companies, there's not this rapid increase in efficiency gains. Actually, efficiency gains are slowing down more recently. And in the case of Japan, they've slowed down really a lot. And yet these countries have been deindustrializing. They're losing employees. How could they be losing employees when productivity isn't growing particularly fast? Once again, the answer is that these sectors are just increasing output a lot more slowly than they used to. They're just not growing as fast as they did before. And that's the key to the story. And I'll kind of explain what's going on here in a little bit more detail, but I just want to show you how different it is from what we're being told. These things that I've shown you about the manufacturing sector, they're even worse in the wider economy. For the economy as a whole, when we move to the service sector where most people are employed, we don't see this present period we're living through as a period of incredible technological change. Instead, looking at productivity numbers for the economy, we see that in the US, productivity is growing at half the pace that it used to in earlier periods. And in Germany and Japan, it's growing at between a fifth of the pace and a tenth of the pace at what it used to. So in the past, productivity was doubling every 10 years in Japan. Now it's doubling every 100 years. So we're growing so much more slowly than we used to. And what this shows me is that if we think about technology as destroying jobs, we actually see that the big problem today is not that job destruction rates are accelerating. It's really that the pace of job creation is slowing down. And one reason why we know that's true is because think about the situation of young people all over the world. What's happening to them? They're finding it very hard to get jobs. And I think in Spain, you have a very extreme version of this, where it's not really that people who have jobs are losing them at a really rapid pace. It's that younger people who are trying to enter the job market are having a lot of trouble finding work. And, you know, that makes sense because these countries, their economies are just slowing down. They're growing a lot more slowly than they used to. These numbers here are just GDP growth numbers for the US, Germany, and Japan, the three leading economies in the developed world. They're just growing a lot more slowly than they used to. And this phenomenon is known by economists as secular stagnation. What economists, some economists have pointed out, it was a very radical idea, and now it's kind of a mainstream accepted idea, is that countries have been experiencing this process of secular stagnation for a very long time. Over time, the growth rate of these economies has just slowed as they've become more advanced. So why is this happening? Why is it? And I mean, for me, it's very surprising that people you know, are talking about how everything is speeding up so much, when in reality, it's that everything is slowing down. And I'll say a little bit about why it feels like things are speeding up when actually they're slowing down. So basically, what you have to know is that in the service sector, productivity just grows at a slower pace than in manufacturing. Basically, in industry, it's very easy to make people's work more efficient by giving them tools and machines. But in a lot of services, it's very hard to make people's work more efficient in the same way, because a lot of services are relational. They involve a lot of non-repeatable or odd events. They're not as standardized. And for these reasons, productivity grows more slowly in services than manufacturing. And also prices grow more quickly in services compared to manufacturing. That's called Baumol's cost disease. It's a very well understood process. And the result of this phenomenon is that services just get more and more expensive over time. And as our incomes grow, or as people's incomes grow, they spend more and more of their money on services. They have to devote more and more of their incomes to services. And so here I'm showing this for South Korea. It's true in all these countries, but South Korea, you see it very clearly because the country just grew at such a rapid pace. But you see this radical increase in the share of all output, the share of the whole income of society that comes from services. And the really simple point is the more money people spend on services, the less money they can spend on goods. It's really that simple. And so this demand shift where people were spending more money on services and less in goods happened first in the richest countries of the world, and then it kind of moved down the chain from there. But it affected the whole world because rich countries are also the countries that buy most of the manufactured goods from the rest of the world. Basically, the richest countries like the US, also the EU, they're the main consumer markets for all of these goods around the world. And so what happened is that as trade increased around the world, they were chasing, all these exporters were chasing markets that were growing much more slowly than before. And that meant that competition increased. It became a lot harder to sell things. People had to compete a lot more because there was more competition. There was more battle for a small or not as quickly growing market. And that, I think, people's experience of things speeding up is really the experience of this heightened competition that comes from everything slowing down. As this happened, world growth of manufactured goods just decelerated. You know, it's not that it's not that people buy fewer manufactured goods than before. It's that the rate at which manufacturing increases in size, increases in value, increases in output, that has shrunk significantly over time since the 1970s. And you can see here, this is a measure of manufacturing and agriculture. Over time, the growth rates in manufacturing have come to look like the growth rates in agriculture. Agriculture is also an industry that's very oversupplied, a lot of additional competition. And this has been reported very recently as affecting even the most newest goods. So the latest news right now, the US and the EU want to increase their production of electric vehicles, of solar panels, of electric batteries, of wind turbines. And those markets are already oversaturated. China already produces enough to meet all the demand in the world for these goods. So these sectors that Europe and the United States were hoping would be sectors of growth for them turn out to be just as affected by overproduction and overcapacity and slowing market growth as everything else. The key thing that I want you to understand is that when industry went into decline as an engine for the whole economy, nothing replaced it. And the service sector, most of all, like all these services people do in education, in healthcare, personal services, working in entertainment, all of those are just very low productivity jobs. And so as all these people transition from working in industry to working in the service economy, that transition has been associated with ever slower productivity growth. And as a result, ever slower economic growth. So there's been this real deceleration in the growth of the economy. And again, that's just because services can't really generate that kind of growth pattern that we saw in industry. It's really that simple. And the result of slowing economic growth rates, especially in a capitalist economy, doesn't have to be true in any economy, but in a capitalist economy, that tends to result in higher rates of unemployment, higher rates of underemployment, more job insecurity, more income insecurity, and rising economic inequality. Now, you might want to know, what about ChatGPT? What about these new technologies that are transforming how we interact with computers? Are they going to deliver these gains that we haven't seen so far? Are they going to get us to artificial general intelligence? A lot of people ask me this question. And the truth is, I don't know. But I can tell you why I have some doubts about ChatGPT's ability to do that. ChatGPT is what's called a large language model. It's a type of computer program. And it's a specific kind of large language model called a transformer. And I'd be happy to explain what that means. ChatGPT, the company OpenAI, developed this transformer that uses this special technique called reinforcement learning from human feedback. And that's why you can interact with it as if it were a text message, as if you were texting your friends. Basically, you know, ChatGPT seems to be able to do anything, and it learns all these things from a very simple technique applied on a very, very large scale. These two techniques are called next token prediction and masked language modeling. And it's very simple to understand what this means. Basically, the programmers give ChatGPT a text and they ask it to fill in the blank. So they use a phrase in English, it's an obvious phrase, hopefully in Spanish too. They say something like, the cat sat on the blank. And then ChatGPT predicts what's the next word in that sentence. The cat sat on the hat, the cat sat on the mat, the cat sat on whatever. And then the programmer reveals what the real word was. And then the ChatGPT adjusts its algorithm to try to guess better next time. Mass language modeling, which ChatGPT doesn't use so much, is a very similar technique. They just cover a word in a sentence and they ask ChatGPT, you know, the blank sat on the, and they say, what do you think the word is? Is it cat? Is it person? Is it whatever? And again, then they show it what the real word is and there's an adjustment. So all of this text is fed into the system and the algorithm is trained to predict what these missing words are. One of the big problems with these models like ChatGPT is what's called alignment. So they are just being asked to fill in the blank from all of this text, but often they do it in ways that we don't expect or want them to. So ChatGPT was trained on all this data taken from the internet. And we know the internet is full of hateful speech, it's full of biased speech, it's full of conspiracy theories, it has all this inappropriate material. And so OpenAI figured out a way to train the model so it doesn't produce negative reactions from the users. And I can explain how that works, but basically what I want you to understand is that there's very little reason to think that ChatGPT represents any transition towards artificial general intelligence, toward this breakthrough that everyone's hoping for. It's trained on existing human knowledge, and it tries its best to reproduce that knowledge. Sometimes it does it in exciting ways, but basically all it does is it reproduces to the best of its ability information that it gets from knowledge that already exists in the world. ChatGPT can't do experiments. It can't learn new things. It's just trying its best to predict what the next word is based on what you're asking it. Now, that being said, it might actually help solve some of the problems that I've been describing, these problems of slow productivity growth in services. Recent research shows that ChatGPT has some effect in raising the productivity levels of less experienced workers rather than more experienced workers. So basically, it helps newer workers or less skilled workers perform closer to the average. But it doesn't do very much to help already very productive workers to perform better than they already do. And that might accelerate a dangerous trend in the economy where companies use computers and algorithms to replace higher paid workers with lower paid workers so they can produce the same stuff at a lower price. There's been a big trend unfolding over the last 40 years where less and less of all the income that's produced ends up in the pockets of working people. And that's very related to an earlier graph I showed you, but the way they showed here is that the share of all of the income produced in society that goes to workers has been declining really significantly, both in the richer countries and in the poorer countries. And so my fear is that unless there's wider changes in society, ChatGPT probably won't get us out of our rut, but it might increase inequality in a significant way. So the question is, how does this different way of thinking about what's going on and conceptualizing the problems we face, how does it affect the solutions that we should propose? As I mentioned earlier, a lot of people who talk about automation also support a universal basic income. And something I find really interesting about this is that we see support for UBI on the far right from people who are very right-wing and pro-capitalism. And we also see support for UBI among people on the far left. So it has this character that people are proposing it across the political spectrum. What I want to say is that if automation theorists were right about what's happening in the world, then this idea of a UBI would make a lot of sense because the problem we would face as a society is just a distribution problem. All of these computers and machines, they'd be producing so much stuff. And the only problem is that people wouldn't have enough money to buy this stuff. And in that case, giving them money would solve all the remaining problems of society. But my argument is that something else is going on, that the economy is running down, that it's becoming less capable of generating growth, that there's a problem in the side of production, not just distribution. And one way we can see that is that over the long term, capitalists have just been investing less than they used to. That's basically why the economy doesn't grow as much, because capitalists see that their investments they could make are just not as profitable as they used to be. So they prefer to hold their money in financial forms rather than investing it in expanding production. They're just not opening up factories or buying new machines in the way that they used to. And what we've seen over the past 50 years is that governments are trying to revive this growth engine. They're trying their best to revive stagnant economies, and they're doing it by trying to encourage capitalists to invest more, to invest in expanding the economy. How have governments do that? How do they do that? Well, as they're doing again now in Europe, they're imposing austerity, right? They're trying to say, we will have lower taxes, so you can keep more of the money you make, and we'll cut social services to guarantee you, you know, that you get to keep the money you're making. They've also removed labor protections, particularly for younger workers. They say, okay, you know what, businesses will make it easier for you to fire workers or to exploit them so that you create more jobs and invest more. And of course, governments have also been accumulating just gigantic debts, bailing out banks, you know, doing Keynesian measures. The debt levels of all of these countries has increased dramatically over the last 50 years in an effort to stimulate the economy and get private investors to invest. In English, we say it's kind of like squeezing water out of a stone, that they're trying to, you know, get a little bit more out of this system that just won't deliver. And the reason is clear. It's because capitalist economies really focus on increasing efficiency. That's the ultimate source of profits. So in an era when productivity growth is growing more slowly, in order to get capitalists to invest, societies have to sacrifice more and more to deliver those gains, basically. It's like we all feel this need to be more productive because there's so little chance to actually increase productivity. And at the end of my book, and in a new book that I'm writing, I ask, is there another way to do this? Do we have to live this way? And I think the answer is no. There's a beautiful vision at the heart of the automation story. It appeals to people because it's a story about how we could live in a world where we don't have to worry anymore about our survival, where in some fundamental way, we can be okay and everyone else can be okay too. The automation theorists say we can only get that if we have automation. But I don't think they're right. I think it's possible to bring about that kind of post-scarcity world, a world without worry, without having full automation. And in saying that, I look back to this 500-year tradition that where social theorists for the past half millennium have been saying that with these technologies we already have, we should be able to reduce the amount of work people do and increase their experience of security. Even if we go all the way back to Thomas More, to the book Utopia, this is really what he emphasizes in that book. I think people don't understand what that book was really about. It wasn't about a world where you could have anything you want. It was a world where everyone felt okay. So he says in Utopia, no one is a pauper or a beggar. And although no one has anything, all are rich. For what greater wealth can there be than to be completely spared any anxiety and to live with a joyful and tranquil frame of mind with no worries about making a living? Thomas More was living in this era of the emergence of capitalism, and he was watching all of these people lose their land, become insecure, not know how they were going to survive. They were stealing to live, and then they were being killed by the state. And he said, what if we could have a world where people just didn't have to worry about their survival anymore? Wouldn't that be a beautiful thing? And this idea really inspired people. One of my favorite examples of this is, you know, we could talk about Karl Marx's work. We could talk about Peter Kropotkin's work. But the Black activist and scholar W.E.B. Du Bois, I think he summarized it very well, this idea in the 1920s. He said, with work for all and all at work, probably 3 to 6 hours would suffice and leave abundant time for leisure, exercise, study, and avocations or hobbies. Shall we all, who shall be artists and who shall be servants in this world to come? Or shall we all be artists and all serve? You see this idea that not that we need some special technology to get to this world. We could get there if we just shared the work that we have to do and also shared what we make in a way that ensures that everyone has enough and they don't have to worry about their survival. And so I think that even without full automation, we could get to a world like that. We could get to a world where we expand not just people's basic incomes, but also basic goods and services, which are really important, that people have access to hospitals and dental care and education and housing and all of these things that they need and that markets are not very good at providing. We would want to reduce the amount of work that anyone has to do. So there's many people who are overworked in our society and people who are underworked, and kind of creating more of a balance there would be really important. So would transforming a lot of housework. Obviously, women do a very disproportionate share of this work. So organizing that work and ensuring that everyone has everyone, you know, contributes if they can. If they can't contribute, that's also okay, but people contribute if they can. And people also feel free from having to worry about how they're going to survive. In order to get there, we'd have to change the way we organize our economy. The capitalist economy just isn't going to be able to get there on its own. Whereas a public economy, where we decide, okay, we're going to use our resources not to set up all of these delivery apps, but to build hospitals or housing or actually meet people's needs, that would require a real transformation in how we organize the economy. And in order for that economy to actually meet the needs that people have, we want to make sure that that economy is more democratic. We don't want a world where everyone has to decide on everything, but we want to create institutions where the kinds of things we produce and the ways we produce them actually reflect the needs and desires of the people themselves. And so I think that, you know, even without full automation, and especially given the kinds of technologies we have today, we could organize the world very differently, and we could achieve a lot of what the automation theorists say. Not all of it. We couldn't get to a world without any need for work. We couldn't get to a world where you can have anything you want at the touch of a button, but we could get to a world where we all have what we need and can satisfy some of our wants, where we feel secure in our livelihoods, and you know that we contribute something, but not so much that we can't enjoy ourselves, and that that work is fairly shared. And the whole thing is organized in a way where we feel we have some control over our lives and over what happens. In practice, it's very difficult to say exactly how we would do that. And I've been working for the past 3 years on a book that lays out this vision of how we could organize the economy differently. But I'm going to stop there, and I'm excited to hear your questions.
Pues muchas gracias, thank you very much. Ahora tendríamos un ratito de preguntas, debate. En ese sentido, ya os hemos pedido para que Marta pueda descansar un poco, que si os podéis traducir a vosotras mismas e intentar que tampoco sea muy largo, haremos como dos vueltas. Entonces, si vais levantando la mano, agrupamos dos o tres preguntas y si podéis traducirlas vosotras a los dos idiomas, os lo agradecemos un montón. Que pasa que ha todo el mundo flaseado.
Me.
Mira.
I don't speak English much, but I would like to talk about in these official statistics about production, about productivity. Historically, the housework that women have done for free is not in the accountability, but there have been some feminist theoricals that has done a contribution about how these official statistics about global productivity would change if we account the housework in terms of economical indicators. Sorry for my English. I don't know if you... And I would like to know if in your next book or in this one, you have took into account these lines of work or of think.
Yeah,
thank you, Aaron.
Of course. Thank you for your question. And I think it's also possible for people to ask questions in Spanish, right? If they want, or is that right, Marta? Yeah. So this is a very important point that women's work, because it's not traded, you know, housework, because it's not traded on the market, it doesn't show up in the statistics, right? And so all these contributions that women are making to the economy aren't counted by the numbers. And I think feminist economists have done a lot of really important work showing how much of what society produces is actually done by women and other people, of course, also, but primarily women in the homes. And there've been a lot of studies showing, I don't know what the studies look like for Spain, but in a lot of countries, there's still a very large gap between the work that the men do at home and the work that women do at home, right? What's interesting about that, for what I've been talking about, is that actually since the 1970s, a lot more of the work that women did at home is now done on the market. So a lot of people who used to produce a lot of food at home now buy a lot of their food outside. And part of the reason is that women are just working more, right? They have less time to do the kind of homework that they used to. They still do a lot of work, but you know, more of the work that they do is now done by the market. We also see that with childcare, right? Like more childcare is being done not by parents, but by people have to hire childcare services sometimes. In some countries, the government does that work. So what's relevant to the story I'm telling is that this work, it's very important that, you know, we do that work differently and we do that work better, and that the work is not a burden to women because it has all these effects on their lives, obviously. But that work remains very low productivity work, right? Like, you know that childcare is better when each person caring for children watches fewer workers, right? If you went to a daycare and they said, we have one daycare worker for every 1,000 children, you would say, this is a terrible place. I don't want to put my kid here. But that's the kind of problem across the whole economy, right? The problem is that a lot of work is like that. Schools, hospitals, you know, these are all jobs where it's still the case that we know you get the best care when people spend more time with you, right? And that's not a bad thing. It's just that in capitalism, in an economy that's so dependent on growth, productivity growth, efficiency, these activities are like a problem for our system. And, you know, so if we lived in a different society that cared about efficiency, we should always care about that, right? But also cared about how people's lives go, their well-being, whether they're happy, whether the distribution of this labor is just, whether we're raising our children right for the next generation, you know, those things would also matter in a different kind of society. So what presents itself as a problem in capitalism could actually be something that we just care about more in a different society. So I hope that makes sense. I'm saying that this kind of work, it's now much more part of the market than it used to be. But it displays all the same issues from the perspective of capitalism, that it's just very low productivity work. That's also why the state and businesses are always calling for cuts to childcare, right? They want to spend less money on this very essential activity. And so it's just another sign, in my view, of, yeah, what's wrong with the society we live in today.
So, for example, in case of talking about productivity as a core concept in our new society, we could think about fulfillment, for example, or as a core concept, for example.
Yeah, buen vivir, right? That's the Spanish idea, I think.
Thank you, Aaron.
Thank you. I see Victor and Pablo have questions in the chat. I can also kind of read Spanish. So if you want to make a question, I can, and if you write it down, I can understand. But if you say it, I'll need a translation.
Again, I can speak in English, so
it's
all right. So first of all, thank you so much, because I think your ideas and point of view are very lively. So I'm very encouraging for a study a little bit more in those kind of things. And I have a couple of questions. My first question is about how these productivity is measured. Because the thing I saw is, okay, there is a dependency between employment and outcome, but I cannot see how measure the productivity without those, right?
Yeah.
You can answer as you wish.
Okay, yeah, sure. I mean, basically, all countries measure the size of their economies and their growth in the same way. What they do is they look at all the money that a company generates in revenue, and then they subtract all the costs that the company has to pay for everything except labor. So, you know, if you have a car company, maybe they buy all this steel and glass and parts, right? And they subtract all that out so that the only thing that's left is the profits and the wages, the part that actually gets paid to businesses or people. That's how it works. And it's called value added. And the reason they do that is they don't want to double count anything, right? So the value of a car includes some of the value of the companies that supplied that car. So it's organized in this way where they just want to say how much value is being added by this specific company, and then they add that up. And in this way they do it, they measure that in terms of the money the company makes. So there's this kind of identity. It's really the same thing. You can either say how much profit and wages is this company generating, or how much output is it generating. It's measured the same exact way. Now, you know, as we've seen recently, there's a big problem with inflation, right? So the value of money declines. So what economists do is they try to account for that inflation, and that's called real value added. So when I talk about real value added for manufacturing, it's just like that number GDP, but only for manufacturing. It's the same exact idea. Like when you hear the economy grew by whatever percent, I've just been talking about that same number, but only for the manufacturing sector to show you what's going on there. One of the ways that I think about it, and that a lot of economists do, is they say that when you account for inflation and you have these real values, it's the same as talking about the volume of production. So if we can account for inflation, if a car company produced 3% more income, 3% more output, it's equivalent to saying that they produced literally 3% more cars, like the physical cars rolling off the assembly line. It's harder to measure those things when it comes to hospitals or schools, right? But, you know, economists try their best to measure that, and they know how much income is being produced in these sectors. And so they use that to make these estimates of how much output is being produced. So I'm just using here like the absolute most standard statistics. If you're a Marxist, you might say, well, I don't know. I think some of this labor is productive and some of it is unproductive. Heterodox economists have a lot of ideas about how it should be organized, how those statistics should be organized differently, what should count, what shouldn't count. I think those debates are important, but the numbers I use are just the standard ones that the government generates, because I want to show that these relationships hold even if you use the numbers that the official governments use. So does that help at all?
Yeah, pretty much.
About productivity. Productivity is just real value added. It's just the income that company produces divided by the hours of work that people do. So if you have a company that produces 10 cars for every 1 hour of labor, that's the productivity of that company. If it rises to 20 cars per hour of work, obviously no company produces that many cars, but just that idea, they produce 20 cars per, and then it double, productivity double. That's all it is. And it doesn't matter where that comes from, the way the statistics work. Let's say that productivity doubled because all these machines came in. Well, you'd still say that we're producing twice as many cars for every hour of work. It's just that that work is now supported by all of these machines. That's kind of an introduction. Anyway, does that make sense? Do you have any questions? I'm happy to talk about this more if you want to learn more.
Yeah, I mean, the point there is basically productivity have some variables. The first variable is the outcome, and mm-hmm. the other value are the people which is doing something. So
that's all it is. Pregnant.
So mm-hmm. it's a little bit weird for me to having this kind of because in the question you show us. Is like okay, everything is there, but how to measure prop? I mean, you can measure very easily the employment because how many people is working. You can measure quite easy as well the outcome because you can measure how much money have you done. But productivity is like the weird thing, and you can.
But it's just one divided by the other. That's
yeah,
it.
Yeah,
it's very
yeah,
simple.
Yeah. But this is like you cannot measure that digitally. You can measure other stuff. Mm. You can measure labor and outcome, but there is not a way to measure digitally like with a rule the productivity. It's like always you have to do some calculations to do that.
Well, it could be that what you're thinking of is what economists call marginal productivity, which is where you try to say, what did this actual worker contribute? What was this worker's productivity? But the normal way the statistics are that I use, and it's good for me, is that they don't care who's actually doing the work. It's just how much are you getting for every hour that people work? It's that simple. And it's not trying to calculate, oh, was this really because of this worker or because of a machine? It just tells you how much is being produced for every hour of work. And it's one of the main sources of economic growth. If you read Adam Smith, Wealth of Nations, he says that the income of the society comes from two things. How many hours people work, how productive they are for every hour they work. And that's still true today. So it's, I can see how it can be confusing, but in a certain way, I mean, maybe it's just because I've been studying it for so long. For me, it's just, it's that simple.
Well, thank you so much again. And very glad to meet you.
No problem. Thank you.
Había una pregunta también de Pablo.
Sí, no sé si me oís. Y el video parece que no va, pero bueno. If you can hear me, I can ask the question in English.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, first of all, thanks for the talk. It's been really helpful. And my question, it's a simple question. It has to do with the three main trends that you described at the beginning of the talk. About automation and I think you mentioned accelerationism. Mm-hmm. We know about the work of Nick Land and Mark Fisher's work and some others. You also mentioned the fully automated communism mm-hmm. book by Aaron Bastani. And So I would like to ask, where does your approach and your proposal stand among those strands? I mean, thinking about the end of your talk, you were talking about the that sort of the end game, the horizon. Where do we go in terms of society? So my question would be, what do you think about those trends that you mentioned at the beginning? And is your approach closer or similar to one of those three trends?
So basically, my view is very simple. I think that those thinkers are wrong about what's happening. They look at what people are saying in Silicon Valley, and then they say, "What if this is true? Then what should we do?" You know? And the problem is that Silicon Valley is wrong. Silicon Valley is trying to sell something, and we shouldn't believe them about what they're selling. Like a lot of these new technologies, they haven't really made workers more productive. They've just made it possible for companies to capture more of the value that's produced. We're not living in an age of incredible, accelerating technologies that, if we just push them a little harder, would bring us to some kind of paradise on Earth. On the contrary, a lot of these technologies are relational. They're about monitoring workers, collecting information about them, punishing them, also providing, bonuses to them on a micro scale. A lot of these technologies aren't just about making workers work better. They're about increasing the power of employers within work. And that's something that I think that the automation theorists were a bit deluded about, because they only looked at these beautiful visions of Elon Musk and, Jeff Bezos and Mark Zuckerberg, that we are going to mine the asteroids and all this stuff. Maybe we will one day. I'm not saying it's not possible. We could see it, but there's very little right now that suggests that's happening. Actually, kind of the opposite is happening. And a lot of technologies are being used for domination and control instead of for bringing us to this beautiful world. So I think that's the first thing, is I just think that they are empirically wrong about the trends. They are listening to what very rich and powerful people are saying about what they're doing, not what they're actually doing. That's one thing. And then the other thing is that I think that accelerationism and these different ideas, what they do is they make it seem like we don't have to solve the problem of how to build a better world. They make it seem like all the problems that existed in the Soviet Union, that existed in, different forms of social democracy, whatever you want to say, all these past efforts to build a better world, the fact that they failed doesn't matter, because suddenly we just have these technologies that are going to solve all the problems for us. And I just think that that's wrong. I think we can solve those problems. We can figure out how to build a different economy that's not a capitalist economy. But we actually have to think about what went wrong in the past and come up with solutions. You know, that's an effort. It requires an effort of thinking. And I think that the way that these authors look to technology actually serves as a blockage to thinking. So I think it's very inspiring. I read a lot of science fiction. I think we should be inspired by this idea that we could get to a world where no one goes hungry, where no one feels unsafe, where people feel like their life is about pursuing their dreams, not how are they going to survive, But we're only going to get there if we think a little bit more about how to get there. And not just saying that if we push the current trends, they'll kind of lead us there automatically. I just don't see the empirical evidence for that claim. So that's kind of why I wrote the book. And I try to make it as clear as possible that I'm not, I mean, Nick Land is a horrible racist. I'm not writing the book for Nick Land. But Nick Cernicek is a really amazing person. And he actually wrote one of the blurbs. He supported my book. And I think he did that because in the book, I don't say that people like Nick Cernuschek are stupid. I don't think any of these ideas are stupid. I just think that they're not enough and that we have to try a little harder to get where we want to go. And we have to think about it a little bit more. So I always tell people that I wrote the book to, you know, for people who believe in these theories, you know, to show them what I think the truth is about what we can do, and to show them why some of those claims are wrong. So I hope that makes sense.
Right. Yeah, it did. So, and there's one follow-up question. And in order to kind of get to the place that you were describing at the end of the talk, would it be like the key to not, I mean, would the key to a change in society be using technology, but changing the production model and kind of maybe using technology, changing hands, I would say. The technology changing hands instead of being under the control of Silicon Valley, making, I don't know, regular people, common people be able to benefit more from technology instead of having to go through these gatekeepers in Silicon Valley.
I think that's a good start. I'll tell you what I think, because I can say it very easily from what you said. I think that we should change the hands, you know, who controls these technologies, like you said, right? But the question is why? What is it that we can do with these technologies that they're not doing, right? Like, why would we say we could make a better world if it was in our hands? And I think the answer is that in capitalism, profits really come from increasing efficiency. Profits are about trying to figure out how to do something more cheaply. The more cheaply you can do it, the more money you can make, right? And, you know, that's kind of the key to the whole game of capitalism. But there's nothing about technology that says that it needs to be used only for efficiency. We can use technology. We can develop technologies in all kinds of ways. We can develop technologies that make our work better. We can develop technologies that make it so we don't even need products anymore, you know, to transform how we do things in ways that make it, you know, so we don't have to buy stuff as frequently, for example. Like, we can make technologies that improve the sustainability of how we produce. We can make technology, whatever goal we have, we can start to invest in this kind of broader sense of the term. We can start to use our resources and our know-how and our science to develop technologies down all these different roads. We can change the way technology works in all these ways. But in capitalism, the way technologies get developed is very constrained by the needs of Silicon Valley and capitalists. So I'm not talking about a world where we get rid of technology. I'm actually talking about a world where we can free technology from the constraints that it has in a capitalist society, and where we actually use technologies to meet all the different needs we have, right? Because the automation people, they focus a little bit too much on the idea that what we want is more stuff. And all over the world, people need more. We already have the technologies to give those people the more that they need. But what we need is not just more stuff, we also need to produce it differently. And we need to produce it with different goals in mind. And that's what I think. That's what I think we could do if it changed hands. So part of, to me, I would say one problem is people focus too much on this idea that the technology will get us there automatically. And the other problem to me is people just say, well, it would be better if we had the technology, right? That's totally true, but they don't explain why. What is it that we could do with this technology that's not being done now? That to me is the really important question. So a lot of my book is about answering that question. It's very different. The book I'm writing now is very different from Aaron Bastani's book, because I'm not saying, well, in the future, we're all going to have every single thing that we want, anything we dream of we can have. I think that's one vision of the future, and it's very exciting to think about those possibilities, but it misses everything else we could do, right? And that's kind of what what I think maybe could inspire people a little bit too. So that's I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, totally. Thanks very much.
Tenemos dos cuestiones y sería con las que ya cerraríamos. Está la de Mario, la de Claudia y ya serían las últimas preguntas, si os parece. Mario.
Hello, can you hear me?
Mm-hmm.
Hello, Aaron.
Hello.
Was a complete delight to hear from you. I got two questions. First of all, you mentioned your skepticism on AGI, and I want to put you in as an economic historian or historian of labor. What are the tail risk, if you want to call it like that, that we have something like that in the maybe a few decades in the perspective of the past, like the enormous increment in productivity from Industrial Revolution? Like, what insights we can extract from the previous experience of that radical change of how people are productive? And the second is maybe less related, but as an expert of labor, you mentioned the trends in the United States and in productivity. Right now, the labor market in the United States is extremely tight.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if you can make some insights. I was very surprised by the very strong payrolls data. And
yeah,
it's something that I can't understand, that with these high rates, the US economy is so tight, so strong, and the perspective of labor, manufacturing, with all the CHIPS Act of Biden, how all of this interact with the productivity trends and the COVID structural change? What you can tell me about that will be perfect.
Yeah, well, you asked some really important questions. So, on the risk of artificial general intelligence, I think that the true answer is we just don't know, right? We don't know what the chances are for developing it. I trust, you know, some of the, there's two reasons why I'm skeptical about what's going on right now. One is that, like last night, I went to hear this lecture by this woman, Raman Chowdhury, who's a big thinker about AI. And, you know, she runs this group called Humane AI, and she's very interested in, like, how can we make these things work better? And she speaks a lot in Congress. She's like one of these 100 most influential people on AI. And she said, look, you know, I don't think that this is happening right now. I don't. And actually what she said, which mirrors what they're saying in the Wall Street Journal every day, is that it's not really clear how good the generative AI technologies are going to be in a business context. We still don't really know. And the big companies are very cautious about using it because the technology is very brittle. So there was this case where Air Canada set up a chatbot that was based on artificial general intelligence, and the chatbot invented a policy that wasn't the real policy of the company. And this man who'd been given this policy was a bereavement policy. So it's like a policy that applies when you buy a flight because someone died, you know, and you have to go to the funeral. The judge said, look, your technology told this person what the policy is, and you have to honor that policy. And that seems very likely that that's going to stick, you know, that companies are going to be held responsible for what these technologies say. So I think that, you know, with what we're doing right now, I trust the people who say that we can't get to artificial general intelligence from what we're doing right now, and the uses of this technology are still not so clear. I think that could we get there in the next few decades? There was a study that showed that if you go back 75 years and you look at all the predictions about artificial general intelligence, the average length of time that the core researchers say it will take to get there is 40 years. So every year people say that it's 40 years away. And today people also say that it's about 40 years away, a lot of people. So I just think like it could happen. But we don't know, there's nothing happening right now that makes us believe or should make us believe that we're almost there. The thing I want to say too is I think that Silicon Valley has just really miscalculated. I think that the big new technologies that could change our lives are energy technologies. I think that if you want to know about what could be a world transforming discovery, it would be nuclear fusion. And just advances in battery technologies and solar and wind, these could create a world, not just where we, you know, a lot of environmentalists think we have to get ready for a world where we have less energy, but they might be wrong. We might be moving to a world where we have more energy through these systems. Why doesn't Silicon Valley talk about that? Because China owns all that technology. They're the ones racing ahead on all these green technologies. They have enough solar panel production capacity for the entire world. And it's a huge problem now for the EU and the US that they did not invest in these technologies. So I think that there's a kind of miscalculation about what the breakthroughs that we're seeing now could be. And I'm not saying it couldn't happen, you know, but I would just say that there's a kind of strange myopia about where the breakthroughs are being made that could be so transformative right now. On the question of the tight labor markets, you know, this is a problem for me. Like I didn't think it was going to be like this. And so how well the US economy is doing is a surprise for me. And, you know, I'm waiting to see what happens. I think that, you know, what's going on right now is a temporary effect of the fact that people saved a lot of money during COVID and then started to spend a lot of money. That created a lot of supply chain problems. There appeared to be not enough production for all these things that people wanted. And as all this production was brought back online, it caused a lot of inflation, but it also showed really big productivity gains. There's something called a bullwhip effect, which is what happens when there isn't enough inventory, when companies are trying to buy that inventory and there's not enough, and then it ricochets through the whole supply chain. So people try to buy cars that aren't enough. So car companies are trying to hoard computer chips and then, you know, glass or whatever. And the bullwhip effect is like how that demand moves through the supply chain. But the danger is that once the whip is concluded, we'll find out that there's just a lot more capacity to produce things than what people estimated. There was a big article about this in the Wall Street Journal today that they said all the productivity gains so far have been about the repairing of supply chains. And what, you know, US companies are betting on is that as that dies down, the, you know, the effects of the green transition, like Inflation Reduction Act, and the effects of AI will keep the boom going. We'll just have to see what happens. You know, I think that in the green space, what we're finding is that electric vehicle production, there's massive overproduction of green electric vehicles. All these companies are cutting back on production. The EU is dealing with these huge problems, massive oversupplies of solar production technologies. Again, China produces enough of all of these things for the whole world. So it doesn't seem like there's going to be much growth there unless they really clamp down on imports. And that's a problem because it will slow the green transition. The other thing they're betting on is that AI is going to cause these massive increases in productivity. It totally could happen. But, you know, I've said I'm skeptical, but I could be wrong. You know, the thing is that as a historian, you have to be careful about making predictions about the future, right? Because it's more important to me to interpret what's already happened. So I have to just wait and see what the trends are. And if they're very different from what I predicted, then I'll change my theory of what's happening.
Thank you very much for your answers. I will admit that I think the US economy surprised all of us. Let's see. I don't know if no landing. And I think a lot about the COVID changing so much on the inside of the economy that we don't know what's going on after that.
Yeah,
we can't understand. Maybe we have to wait a few decades to understand what really changed COVID in the US economy. So yeah. I was very bearish. And that at my points. The last one, I would say that I understand your skepticism, but I think it's very important to state that it's a very common argument that humans are very bad at thinking in exponentials. And I think we have to take that in consideration because I am skeptical too in the short term, but there are too many factors that we cannot think just for how our mental bias work.
Yeah.
So to put that in consideration. And thank you very much for answering me.
No problem.
Claudia?
Well, we are sharing the computer, but we're in the same class, this thing. Well, thank you, Aaron, for your lecture, your talks today. It was really nice to hear you. And well, the last question that was really interesting, I think mine is not, is more a thought or a Black Mirror question, but it's something that is concerning me a little bit because when you were explaining exactly how the ChatGPT is changing the different kind of workers, you said that I'm not going to say less qualified or the less productive ones, the ChatGPT is helping them just quite much, but the higher ones, let's say, ChatGPT is not really making any change on them. I heard one day, I read that apparently Samsung, some workers of Samsung, they were just looking for some solution of something that they were kind of inventing or something like that. And at some point they used ChatGPT and ChatGPT implement this information on the database, I guess. So when you said that the ChatGPT is just, it's not creating anything, it's just using this information that it's receiving just to create the same information or sharing the same information with different people that is asking sort of the same. Do you think that at some point those, again, I don't want to say less qualified workers, but the ones that are using ChatGPT, because I see in my office that a lot of people are using ChatGPT for really stupid things that they can just write themselves, they can just create themselves, but they don't want to. And at some point, I think, or that's my question about, do you think that at some point everyone is going to just create exactly the same things because just ChatGPT just giving the same ideas? Because we are living on a, well, we are working on a creative fields, and we are kind of worried that the ChatGPT or all these AIs are using all the things that they just find on internet. And there's a lot of problems right now with the copyright and things like
that. Yeah. Yeah, it's very interesting. I mean, one of the biggest problems that OpenAI faces right now is that they're being sued by the New York Times and by other companies because a lot of the answers that the model produces are just plagiarized from other sources. So the New York Times shows that if you ask it certain questions, it just prints New York Times articles, like entire paragraphs. And it has a lot to do with what the model actually does. So the engineers say that it's learning, But it's not clear that what a transformer does when it looks for patterns in text should be described as learning. And, you know, without getting into something too technical, it's sort of like a large language model works with very small snippets of text, but a transformer, which is what ChatGPT is, works with much larger blocks of text or larger blocks of information. And it seems like once it works with that larger block of information, a lot of what the algorithm does is it actually just copies information rather than learning it. And so this has been a big problem. People aren't sure what's going to happen. The OpenAI lawyer said that if this copyright is enforced, then they won't be able to produce their product because they're just admitting that that's what it does. I think that you're right. I always have the experience that when you read about what employers think the technology does, they think it's more creative than it is. And they don't understand that if you ask it the same question, it basically gives you the same answer every time. So if you write a science fiction novel with ChatGPT, you know, if you give it relatively similar ideas, it'll name all the characters the same way. It'll have similar plot points. Like it isn't as randomly generative as people, or I don't know, excitingly generative as people imagine. So I think that in creative fields, that's going to limit it, that it'll be used a lot initially, but then it'll generate very mediocre products and then not be used as much. But I do think that a lot of people say that, that it helps them when they use it for brainstorming. You know, some people say it's easier to work from an example, even when you don't like it, than to work from a blank page. So there are ways that these technologies might help us. But I do, my sense is, at least for now, in a lot of fields, there's an overestimation of how much this stuff can do. And that, you know, like, you know, I like a lot of these, like Uber and the way these apps work, you know, they let companies fire workers and then rehire them as consultants. And I think what we're going to see is a lot of ChatGPT being used in that way too, right? We could imagine that companies will fire creatives and then say to them, what we want you to do is just, you know, to modify this output that ChatGPT is giving us. And that, again, that's part of this relational story where technology is really about struggles over who gets the value from what we produce. So I expect a lot of those struggles to increase in the coming years. And in the United States, we've seen that already with Hollywood, that the Screen Actors Guild, they made a big strike to say, you know, that actors should own their own likenesses and their own voices, and they shouldn't be allowed to sign contracts where they alienate that that information. So again, I think there's going to be a lot of ways that this technology, there's going to be big struggles over who owns and how things are produced that are really struggles over how is this income divided. And that's obviously why we need to make sure that people, you know, get organized, that they fight for their rights, and that they fight to change the law, at least in the short term, because I think that that's going to be, it's just inevitable that that's what we're going to see.
Okay, thank you.
Pues si os parece, con recordando esta importancia de las luchas por lo social, lo dejaríamos aquí. Darle las gracias a Aaron, a Marta, a todas vosotras, vosotros, vosotros. Y nada, el resto nos vemos el próximo miércoles con nuestros compas de Bicolab, con Carlos y con Usue, que también trabajaremos un poco también toda esta historia de la construcción de la IA. Así que muy agradecida a Aaron por haber compartido este rato con nosotros, con nosotras, con nosotros, y a Marta por habernos traducido. Un abrazo.
Thank you so much, Aaron.
Thank you.
Gracias, thank you.
Bye.
Thanks.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.